the World Works, where we have conversations about work and work we've done and jobs we've had and what they've meant to us and what they mean in the greater economy. My name is Kevin Williamson, and here I have with me a guest I've been meaning to talk to for some time, who is conveniently located in-house. This is Kent Lastman, who is the boss at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is hosting these series. Normally, it would be super easy for me to sit down with Kent when I'm doing these videos because I do them from the CEI offices, but I'm actually doing a few remote until I can get myself back to Washington for my sins. So from a frigid Dallas, Texas, everyone's talking about the weather in Iowa this week because it's been the caucuses. No one's talking about the weather in Dallas. It's awfully cold here. But Kent, how are you?
I'm doing really well today, Kevin. It's great to see you.
And our things, we probably shouldn't talk about the weather because this will come out sometime after this has been recorded, but everyone's been freaked out by the wintry tone of winter. It always surprises me when people are surprised that, it snows in Washington in the winter and the East Coast gets cold and snowy and whatnot.
Yeah. You know, it's something of a cliche among outdoor enthusiasts, but I think everyone needs to learn this cliche, and that is there's no bad weather. There's really only bad gear. You know, if you get a coat and a hat, you know, get a pair of gloves, I think you'll be okay.
Preparation matters. You know, I used to live in Connecticut, and every year I would get stopped on the train home from New York for like 2 hours at some point in the spring because it had rained and there were wet leaves on the tracks. And I always say, guys, there have been trains here for 200 years, and it's been raining for all those 200 years. Hadn't figured out how to deal with this. Apparently, they haven't. But that's a rant for another day. We're here to talk about work and jobs and stuff. And I'm interested in your work history. And from a conversation you and I had earlier, I get the feeling that your father and my father had sort of similar ideas about what a good career looked like. So when I was, 17, 18, I would talk to my father about this. And his idea of what you did in life, if you had good grades in high school and all that, as you went to college and you studied either business or something that was similarly practical sounding, and then you went to work for the biggest, most prestigious company you could find and stay there forever. And that's what you did. And, my father would have finished high school, I guess, in the class of 1957 if he'd graduated, but he didn't actually. So got a GED later. So that was it was a very 1957 attitude. And, as an adult, he essentially worked for two big companies his whole life. He worked for Keebler for, I think, 25 years and Procter & Gamble for 20 or 25 years. And the kind of career I had where I studied poetry in college and then popped around and changed jobs and mailing addresses 50 times in 26 years now or whatever it's been has been something that wouldn't have looked like a solid, respectable, prosperous kind of career path, describing it to someone whose views were very much rooted in 1957. What kind of advice did you get from your dad when you were in your teens thinking about what you wanted to do in life?
Boy, the most important advice that he had, were not things that he said. That was not a strong suit of his, communicating with his children orally and giving that sort of, sit down around the fire and have a father-son talk. But he did have lots of advice, especially about work. He graduated high school just a couple years before your father. Served in the Air Force as a something of a expedited decision after getting kicked out of college, and much to the dismay of his, professional parents. His father had been a very prominent dentist in their community, so he went to the Air Force, and then he did some odd jobs before getting hired eventually at John Deere, big manufacturing concern, farm implements. And I was the youngest of four kids. And the expectation was in our household, you would be going to college. The expectation in our community, this little town called Geneseo in Illinois, was not necessarily the case that you would go on to school. About 30-40% of my graduating class didn't go to college. And they turned out just fine. Right. That there was a lot of other jobs to do, a lot of other works, a lot of other paths. But at our house, college was the expectation. And I distinctly remember one of the few times we sat down for those kind of father-son advice talks. It was my senior year of high school. And I let him know after the fact that I had just dropped calculus class. And I wasn't going to do that for the second semester. And he just didn't understand. And it wasn't, he didn't understand the process of how I dropped it. He just couldn't fathom that I was not going to pursue, you know, an engineering degree at the University of Illinois and then go work for a big manufacturing concern in the Midwest, because that was stable. It's something you could count on. And the fact that I didn't have good answers for what I wanted to do instead, it just flabbergasted him. You know,
why did you drop calculus?
It was difficult. I was doing well. You know, I had a good grade and I liked the teacher and all of these things. But it was also one of those classes, as anybody who's taken serious math classes before knows, you had to do the work every single day. Right. And that was difficult for me. I just didn't want to do work when I was 17 years old. And calculus problem sets are not something you can kind of float past. You have to sit down and think and work them out. And I just wasn't willing to do the work. So I thought, well, I'll just skip this. I'll just drop this.
So you didn't really hit the wall mathematically. You hit the wall in terms of work ethic.
It was work ethic. It was motivation. It was... as I now have 17-year-olds living in my household, it was, why does this even matter? When will I ever use this? You know, clearly I knew better than my teachers or my parents about that sort of thing. And so I just dropped it. And yeah, that was a rough conversation. It was rough because I saw genuinely my father was at a loss. He just couldn't comprehend. He didn't understand what I was doing or had done.
Yeah, it's funny, not with my father, but with a football coach, I had a similar conversation when I informed him that I wasn't going to be playing football, I guess my senior year of high school. And he was just perplexed because this is Texas and why would you not play football if you had a chance to play football? And I was explaining to him I wanted to spend more time, you know, working on the school newspaper. And he, what do you expect to come out of that? I don't know, maybe something other than playing for what was at the time the losingest 5A football team in Texas history. You know, it was not a great path of glory playing for Lubbock High School in those years. So you drop calculus, you decide not to go to the University of Illinois. Or did you go to the University of Illinois? Did you ever go there?
No. I ended up at the very last minute applying to school. I came east. I moved to Washington, D.C. when I was 18 years old. I went to the Catholic University of America. Hmm. I started in a program to study politics, which, you know, this was a little bit closer than having nothing for my parents, because they thought, well, there's a government, there's people that do these things, there must be jobs out there, he's going to learn something. There was a little bit of a twist of the screw. About a year later, I double majored. So I added a major and I came home one break and announced that I was going to add philosophy. And so I was a philosophy major now. Mm. And this was akin to, well, what the heck is that? You know, there's nothing practical about that. When you were using those sorts of words at the opening, no concrete jobs come from philosophy.
Yeah, it's like you majored in being a hobo.
Precisely. And hobos are people with dignity too, but, you know, that was not for them.
Yeah, exactly. But before that, let's revisit some of the work you did as a young man, you know, pre-college and that part of your life. Did you ever have, was castrating pigs your worst job?
No. I did farm labor for 3 or 4 seasons in the summer. Mm-hmm. It was a fabulous job. Mostly it involved baling hay and straw, but it also helping with a lot different kind of seasonal activity with livestock, like castrating pigs. Mm-hmm. That's dirty and it's hard, and it's not fun. I mean, especially for the pig, you might think that it's more fun for me than the pig, but it's not fun for anybody. But the worst job I had, was a real inflection point probably in my thinking about work. I had come home from school after freshman year of college. I was working at a place, a factory, and they made cardboard boxes, or they made cardboard that then would be put through machinery and turned into the forms that could be folded into boxes. And these machines, I was a machine operator. I worked on the particular machine I worked on was a two-person job. And my job was to take massive stacks of mostly dried but somewhat damp cardboard and feed it into a one end of a machine that was about the size of a two-car garage. And it would get pressed and inked, and there were knives in the middle that would cut out the slits and things so that you would have the flaps that eventually you could fold together for packaging. And I only lasted there about 2 or 3 weeks. And this was, it was interesting in the sense I worked third shift. So I started at 11 at night. I worked with, primarily with guys that they were lifers. They were gonna, this was their career. I liked them. I got along with them. But I was covered every morning in paper dust. I had cuts from my fingertips up, you know, to the basically to my armpits, because you're lifting with two arms these pieces of paper, heavy paper. And I, all of these cuts had been dyed. So they were like blue and black and orange and red. And so I looked like a circus guy.
Your tattoos.
Very strange tattoos. But the moment that changed was when one of the bells rang. So they had these throughout the floor, a very big operation, several acres under a roof. They had these kill switches. So everything would come to a stop if there was a problem or an injury. And a guy about two machines over had his forearm, his hand and his forearm crushed, stuck in the machine. So everything came to a halt, you know, earplugs come out. There's like designated safety protocols. And I was in my my second or third week. So this was the first time I'd ever seen it. And, you know, it made a big damper on morale that evening. Paramedics, there's, I mean, it's a big, serious injury. But what made me want to walk away was the following day. The conversation was, well, that's what happens. You know, and from the foreman, from the other operators, from, like everybody was like, well, that, you know, my ticket didn't get punched, so everything's okay. And I just thought, this, I can't do this. This is not how I want to be making my money to pay for tuition, because that could be me, disabled, you know, and I'm not that good at this. You know, I've only been doing it a few weeks. I'm probably more prone to error. And
someone listening to this podcast is now thinking, and so you decided to dedicate your life to repealing business regulations.
That's right. You know, the coda to the story is important here. Mm-hmm. That guy was fine. He did not lose his job. He did have his arm crushed. I mean, it was crushed. It was a very serious injury. But he did not lose his arm. He did not lose functionality. And he came, I checked a couple years later, actually. I checked. He came back to work. He stayed employed there. This was a good, meaningful job for him. Mm-hmm. And whatever led to that accident, employees' relationship with the employers was such that they thought of it as, we need to take care of each other. So there was no litigation. There was no, I think most of the safety and such was not designed by OSHA. It was designed by the manufacturer.
Yeah.
Because they knew how the machines operated. And so there were certain regulations that had to do with, you know, like ear protection and the type of clothing, you know, safety shoes and things like that. But the real meaningful things that saved that guy's life were training and the people around him and the protocols. What do you do if something goes wrong? Yeah. And
you just reminded me of something. I'm not 100% sure this is true, but I read earlier this week in the course of some reading I was doing on something else that the first civilian hard hat, like for, you know, industrial workers, was adapted from the helmets that were used in World War I at the suggestion of a young insurance inspector by the name of Franz Kafka.
That's a great little anecdote.
Yeah, he had a lot of terrible jobs. I was thinking about this in the course of writing about something earlier that you know, Kafka and T.S. Eliot both had jobs they hated for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And it seems to have really sunk into their writing. Like, you know, Kafka's whole career as a writer is about these, you know, incomprehensible, inhuman bureaucracies and the difficulty and crushingness of dealing with them. And you get similar things in parts of Eliot, although not as dramatically. So that was the worst job you ever had. And you worked from 11 to 7 in the morning, I'm guessing?
11 to 7 in the morning.
So yeah. Cardboard never sleeps, runs 24 hours a day.
It never sleeps. And, you know, we were located right near interstates. So there was a shipping schedule. You had to meet your numbers because the trucks would be backing up every morning.
I have a theory. I guess there's some research to support this, that overnight work like that is just really bad for people. It's really hard on people. I worked for some time at 7-Eleven on the same hours from 11 to 7 in the morning. And but then more to the point, as a newspaper editor, I worked, you know, getting off work from, you know, 2 to 4 for a long, long time for a lot of my life. And I think that was it's hard on one, you know, sort of socially, emotionally, physically. It's just not good for us to be on a weird schedule like that. But there are jobs where it just has to be that way, where there are times when someone's got to be the guy on the clock at 3 in the morning or 4 in the morning out of necessity. I wonder how we balance those things. You know, obviously there are jobs that need to be done that are dangerous jobs, right? So someone hears about someone getting hurt in an accident in a cardboard factory, and it seems like the trade-off isn't a very good one, right? So it's this trivial, banal thing of making cardboard boxes. Isn't there a safe way to do that? Someone gets hurt being a firefighter who goes into a building and, you know, saves or tries to save someone who's trapped inside. You understand, well, that's work that's just dangerous by nature. But there are important jobs that need to be done that aren't these, you know, kind of heroic, I'm a firefighter, I'm a police officer, I'm a soldier, I'm a paramedic kind of jobs that are just dangerous, like being a miner. You know, mining jobs are just dangerous. They're a lot safer than they used to be, but there's still, you know, danger that's involved in that. Working with big industrial machinery is just more dangerous than working with spreadsheets. It's always going to be. And whatever reforms we adopt to try to make those things less hazardous than they have been in the past are never going to make them, you know, as safe as jobs that are just of a different character. And I guess I've been thinking about this for a while. I remember I had a history class when I was in high school. And if you would listen to my history teacher, the only things that happened in American history were slavery, the New Deal, and the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. And it was mostly the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. It was like right after the Revolution and the Great Depression. That was like the inflection point in American history. For some reason, she was kind of a labor enthusiast and was interested in these things. But there are real questions involved in that, and how we think about trade-offs between the toll that work takes out of us and what we contribute, not only in terms of being able to support ourselves economically, but the more important question, which I think often gets left out, is in the value of what people actually create by their work. You know, the point of a job isn't to get you a paycheck and support your family. That's a happy side effect. The point of the work you do is the work you do. It's the economic output, without which everybody would be impoverished, and we'd all be, you know, living in a kind of Paleolithic standard of living, which nobody really wants. We often overlook those things. You know, you hear about, you know, sort of criticism of pharmaceutical companies often is kind of along those lines, where, you know, well, without this greed or without this or without that, you know, without the pharmaceutical companies, there'd be no pharmaceuticals. And we need those things. They actually do something useful. Yes, they create value for their shareholders and they make profits. And I'm sure there's some, you know, horrible executives riding around Monaco in yachts and doing whatever people like that do. But at the end of the day, they do make useful products, and cardboard boxes are useful products. And having 7-Eleven where I used to work is useful. And having Burger King where I used to work is actually fairly useful. And not nearly as bad as people expect it to be. Burger King wasn't a bad job at all, by the way.
We also I think we tend to, when we talk about work, not just in a policy context, but with family dinners, you know, with friends, we also align in an important point because we just take for granted the locus of decision authority, right? So the point of work, as you're saying, is the value that you can create for others. And then we can see the effects of it. We see the byproducts. We see the effects. It's measured in things like compensation and flexibility and these other attributes. But the purpose of the work is to create the value. And we miss some of that value is getting to pick your own path. And some people will trade off steady hours for taking a shift and shift work. They will take less compensation if they know they can count on those hours. Or they will say, they'll make the calculation about the relative worth and expected value, the future value of pursuing additional education in philosophy. And they'll say, you know what? I'm better off going to the fire academy and being a firefighter for 25 years, taking a pension, and then taking a part-time job as a second career. Mm-hmm. That decision authority is really important and valuable to us as individuals.
You know, there's an often observed thing, tends to be more common among women, but it's not exclusively something you see in female workers. But often people become parents when they decide that they need to spend, you know, more time with their family, or that's going to be a bigger part of their balance. They're going to shift the balance away from work toward family life. They will choose directions within a firm that are less highly compensated. You know, people will go out of, say, commission sales work where you can make a lot of money into a different department like, you know, human resources or something administrative, where your hours are more predictable, your income's more predictable. And if it's producing income adequate to what they want out of that job, then the trade-off of not having the uncertainty, the extra hours, the extra work, the stress or whatever of the more high-paying but more difficult, more stressful job is worth it. And often people look at these calculations from the outside when you're studying, you know, compensation questions without being able to see the things that are hard to measure. You know, it's easy to measure income because we've got records of that. It's the empirical thing. But all the other things that go into whether I prefer this job to that job are very hard to figure out. You know, I figure that, you know, in journalism, in the nonprofit world, which is kind of where you and I have spent a lot of our adult careers, you meet a lot of people who probably could have made a lot of money, a lot more money doing something else. You know, there are a lot of people who are working at places like CEI who could have gone and been corporate litigators somewhere and made 30 times what they make or more, who knows. But there are other payoffs to what we do besides just the paycheck. And I think that everyone kind of knows that. Everyone understands that if you bring it up in a conversation. But it's something that's really difficult to incorporate into, say, economic data when you're trying to go to policymakers and help them to understand what they can do to help people get more out of their work. You know, we want people to have, how to put it? I don't think that anyone from the outside can prescribe what the optimal, you know, balance is in terms of employment versus doing other things, people being full-time employees versus part-time employees versus kind of gig employees versus emphasizing other things in life. But I think we would all probably agree that we would prefer to have a kind of economy where people who want full-time jobs can basically get them. People who want to do X, Y, and Z have lots of opportunities to do X, Y, and Z and to reach a place in their own lives where they can make these decisions about balance, about income versus other things themselves. But when you go to policymakers with the economic data we have, it's often very difficult to get all of that intangible stuff into the conversation, don't you think?
I do. And maybe a concrete example will help help our discussion here and help our audience. And again, I'm going to draw from the experience of my father. and contradict something I said earlier about he wasn't always the best, you know, father-son talks. We did talk more about these things and life, and he was much more reflective and shared more as he aged, which I think is not uncommon. But one of the patterns that we witnessed as a family that he found tremendous rewards in, and I know his children profited from, is the following. He went and did that career, that stable, practical job. And he wasn't around a lot. You know, he didn't coach the Little League. He didn't, he wasn't, you know, collecting money for the Kiwanis on the weekends or whatnot. He was busy at work. Later in his, he retired early. He kind of floundered around for a few years, maybe 5 or 7 years. And he did work. He worked on a construction crew. He did different things. But the trajectory that he saw for himself, where he would just go out and find another job in his mid-50s as an engineer, that didn't pan out. And he transitioned for that late stage part of his life and became a real estate agent.
Hmm.
And at this point is when he really started to value and invest in social capital. He became something of, it's probably too strong, although he would love to hear it if he were living, you know, like the pillar of the community, right? So he would volunteer on different boards. For the local Christmas Victorian walk, you know, all the businesses downtown would decorate. He would dress up like an old-time Santa. You know, he really relished investing in his now adult children, or nearly adult in my case, in their lives and in their families and in their community. And the benefit that we take socially, the pro-social behaviors of people changing focus throughout their lifetime, I think is very difficult to get our arms around and name and put numbers on, but it's there. We all see it. We all know that it happens. We want people at different stages of life with different experiences to be able to do different things and pursue different types of jobs, because it makes available this richness in our cultural fabric.
So after college, what do you do?
Well, actually a little bit before that, I worked my way through school. You know, so I was a lifeguard and I coached a swim team, but I also started while I was in school as a research assistant at a young, new think tank in Washington, D.C. And I worked hourly. I remind people, or I tell our interns every class, the core value that I was hired for was not my intellect. I didn't have any great writing skill. I didn't know a lot. In fact, I knew very little about public policy. But as a local student, I had a student ID that acted as a library card to all of the university libraries in the Washington, D.C. area, which was, I think, what I was hired for, was access to all those libraries.
What year was this?
This was 1994.
Okay.
So no email addresses at work, no. A couple years later, I think we got AOL at the office. I started doing research, and I proceeded from there to, you know, eventually I was doing research for the president of the organization on all of his projects. I went to work at another organization. I was a research assistant for a former Reagan cabinet official who was working on a book, Jim Miller served as OMB director. I learned a tremendous amount from Jim. I hold him in the highest esteem. And as I have told him before, I never would want to work for him again. He was a bit of a tyrant of a boss, but a brilliant man and a wonderful, kind person. And I just proceeded kind of, you know, working on, eventually I was working on a set of issues, telecommunications regulation, then state telecommunications regulation, managing projects, and it just kind of snowballed from there.
And did you move into the state telecom stuff because you were particularly interested in it, or because you saw opportunity for specialization and it was an underserved part of the market, or how did that happen?
I there's a confluence of two or three factors. I did not spot the market opportunity that you just identified. You know, that it was an underserved market for analysis. A former boss of mine, so the first factor was I got married and moved away. And so now I was living in a state capital. I was living in North Carolina, in Raleigh, North Carolina. Secondly, a former boss of mine, he said, you know, I've got this idea for a new project. And I've got all these people employed at this think tank working on trademark law and the FCC-related regulation and the Telecom Act and its implementation. But I think there should be a focus on what the state public utility commissions are doing. Would you look at my proposal? Because I'm going to try to get this funded. And I gave him, detailed feedback on what would work, because I now had some experience in a state capital that was interesting to him. And lo and behold, 3 or 4 months later, he called back and he said, I got the proposal funded. When can you start? And I didn't realize that my comments on helping form the proposal was actually a job interview. But sure. That's how it worked out.
A lot of jobs happen that way, particularly in places like Washington, where so much of working life is socially driven. You know, yeah. When's the last time you got a job by seeing an ad saying help wanted this, that? Was it the cardboard factory?
I think it probably was. I mentioned lifeguarding. Like, even that was social, right? Because yeah. I hung around pools. All of these things were really word of mouth and people putting your name forward, that sort of thing.
How much of that do you think drives the significant income differences between cities and non-urban workers? I think it's got to be a huge part of it.
I think it's large. Yeah, very large. There's another large component that it's worth mentioning. By their nature, cities, they concentrate talent. They attract and then concentrate talent in different fields. And there is something of a flywheel effect, right? So once London starts developing a finance industry, it then attracts even more talent into finance. And some of the things where that flywheel effect can have the most deepest effects, I think, are industries and jobs where we place high premiums on them in our life, in our culture, in Western culture.
Yeah. I've often argued that we have too many conversations about economic policy as such and too few conversations, particularly on the kind of right side of the political spectrum and maybe the broadly libertarian kind of world, about specifically urban problems. You know, I lived and worked in Philadelphia for a long time, mm-hmm. and people would say, you know, what can we do to get the Philadelphia economy fixed? And I would always think, you don't really need to fix the Philadelphia economy. You need to fix the crime problem in the schools and in some other cities, housing, although it wasn't really much of an issue in housing. And the city will take care of itself. You know, you fix those kind of basic things. You have a city that functions as a city. And as you say, the talent will concentrate and you'll get what you want out of those people economically just by dint of their own, you know, self-organizing economic activity.
And other activity, right? And I know that this is not lost on you, but it's worth underscoring, and maybe a historical reference is useful here. We create goods that people really value, and they matter through time, that are non-economic or things that we don't typically think of as economic. I'm thinking in particular of things like Polish neighborhoods in Chicago and in Cleveland, right? So there are cultural goods. Mm-hmm. That come from concentration that are different than goods produced in a rural economy or a rural community. And for some people, in this case, the example I'm trying to use here, recent immigrant families, those cultural goods are profoundly important. Sure. They become the track through which people develop relationships and marriages and job training and other avenues so that they can be fully part of the American community, you know, fully citizens. And those non-economic goods, I think, really too often get overlooked once we start talking to policymakers.
So I've often said my favorite interview question of all time was from Chris Rock when he used to have a talk show, and he had Jesse Jackson on as a guest. And Chris Rock, who can be just, I mean, he's a comedian, so he's good at this sort of thing, just sort of blisteringly understated at times, as funny as he can be when he's being kind of hysterical. And his first question to Jesse Jackson was, "So Reverend Jackson, what do you do?" And Jesse Jackson was obviously sort of discomforted by the question and took some time to respond. But I often ask people questions that very question, because people who aren't kind of in our world don't really know what a think tank does, don't really know what it means to be the person who's in charge of one. You know, even, you know, my job, people kind of understand that I write stuff and it's a column or it's a story or it's a book, and they kind of get that. But there's a lot of other things that people just don't really understand, even if they know the words. Like, most people have heard of, you know, I work in private equity, or I work at a hedge fund, or I do this or that. But no one really knows what that means for the most part, except for the people who are really in that world and kind of adjacent to it. So, so what do you do?
You know,
the other version of that, I guess, is the question from The Office. So what would you say you do here?
I knew that question was coming, the way you set it up with Chris Rock, and yet it's still discomforting. there are two ways I think we could tackle this. You know, you can start at one end and say, when you add up all the little things, kind of, these are the two or three main projects that I work on. Or you could start with, on different days, how do you spend all your time, Kent? Right? Do you do this? You do that?
Well, I mentioned that. Like, so how much would you say, how much of your job is, say, fundraising?
It varies seasonally, but it's about 60%, 60 to 65%. And I'm a little bit, a few people appreciate it. Our auditors do. But I'm a little bit uptight about this. I color code my calendar so that I can actually know how much time I'm spending on different projects. And so at the end of the month, you know, it's really clear to me how much fundraising I've done, because purple jumps off the screen, you know, just, it's right there. But it's about 60 to 70%. And realistically, for somebody in my role, my peer group or whatnot, including people that don't run think tanks, but major university centers or small schools, you know, if it's less than half, that would be quite abnormal.
Okay.
Right. That's a big part of the job.
So your major job then is fundraising, and then the rest of your work is making sure that the people who work for you are doing what they're supposed to be doing, I assume.
I think of it in terms of two words, and then there's lots of different projects that kind of fit into these categories or these buckets. One of them is, it's the one that my father would have rolled his eyes at. But there's lots of kind of daily tasks related to it. It's, my job is vision. So what are we pointed toward? What projects or issue sets are we going to work more on? Financial regulatory reform or more on labor reform, right? Those sorts of allocation questions. But the vision of the organization and the vision of regulatory law in America, I spend a good deal of time on. And the other set of questions is all about resources. And the easiest one to understand is money, right? You got to keep the lights on. You got to pay for the equipment, there's salaries, et cetera. But there's other resources. Talent, you know, think tanks don't own capital very much. You know, we have some books here. We have some computers, some desks, things of that sort. But that machinery that I told you about back at the cardboard factory, there's no secret stash of think tank machinery. We have human capital. And that means identifying people, cultivating the relationships so that we have a good stream of people that are available to hire that want to be here. So resources is, it's money, but it's equipment, it's our lease, it's all of the kind of behind the scenes things, including, I think most importantly, the people, the human capital. And that is, you know, in the political world, and policy, unfortunately, in my view, unfortunately, is a subset of the political world, and not, you know, politics, you know, having it reversed. In the political world, the competition for talent is fierce.
Sure.
The opportunity for people to work elsewhere is high. You know, they can go where they want.
Yeah. When you first thought that you might be someone who would have the top executive job at a large organization, was there a question of confidence in that for you? Like, am I capable of being in this leadership role? Because there are some people, like, you meet them when they're 11 years old and they're like, yeah, that guy. You're pretty low key, guy. You're not, someone whose voice I hear booming down the hallway a lot saying, you know, right this ship, young man, or something like that. Did you feel comfortable stepping into that role?
I did. And, I've reflected on this before. I've had at least one, if not multiple, long conversations with my wife about it, over the years. And I wonder if there was just naivete, right? I just didn't know how deep I was going to, you know, you can't ease your way into leadership roles. And I think that applies, you know, if you're a Major League Baseball coach, or if you're a think tank executive, or if you're going to be the managing editor at a newspaper, you just need to be ready to do it and learn quickly, because invariably mistakes get made. And they still get made, you know, nobody's infallible in that sort of way. But I was very confident about kind of different mechanical or technical aspects. So I had managed some pretty big projects, multi-million-dollar projects. I had managed multiple teams of people simultaneously, teams of between four and six people, you know, two or three teams at once. I had worked with high net worth individuals and corporate lawyers, and, you know, I'd worked with politicians. So those things were not novel to me. But I'll tell you, the most intimidating part of the hiring process, because there's a comprehensive hiring process when I applied for this job. It was about a 5-month process, multiple interviews and such. But the finalists were invited in for an all-staff meeting. And it was like an ask me anything, right? It was supposedly a brown bag lunch. And so everybody had their lunch in front of them. But it was just 90 minutes of very, very smart people who knew their field and their organization well, peppering me with questions. And not only were they good questions and difficult and all of those things, but these were potentially my, you know, new direct reports. So you don't want to, you know, make them mad before you even get the job.
It's funny. I had a similar job interview one time for a much less senior position at a similar organization. This had a policy at the time of when someone was coming in to interview for a job, the last thing they did was they would come in for a day, and anybody who wanted a meeting with them anywhere in the organization, no matter what your job was, could schedule a meeting with that person and ask them anything, essentially. I mean, within, you know, the bounds of decency and anything kind of professionally related, and including people who had nothing to do with whatever your area was. Sure. And it was a good experience, I thought. It was kind of harrowing, though, and tiring for me anyway, because I'm used to being the person who asks questions, not the person who answers questions as much. And I think that's kind of a good practice, although I suspect that you run into some diminishing returns as the organization gets very large.
You do. And we've been, I've been here not quite 8 years, and we've been growing. It's not a perfectly linear path, but we've been growing consistently year over year. And we've had to adapt some of those systems so that what I think of as this most important asset, this human capital, right? Being able to bring people through the door and help them be productive right away and in ways that fit with our mission and our culture. Hiring is one of the areas that we've probably dramatically changed our systems. And it's so vital, and yet you can't do it the same way when you're, 70% larger or whatever the numbers are. You just can't do it the same way.
Yeah,
everybody can't have an opinion at a certain point.
Well, at least not one that gets heard. If you'd taken a different path in life, you know, if you hadn't done what you're doing now, what do you think you'd be doing? What would your plan B be? What would your plan B be, which is a hard thing to say, if you could, you know, go back and talk to the 20-year-old version of yourself and say, okay, you're going to do this thing, but here's the other thing you could do. What's the other thing look like?
Yeah. These counterfactuals, these are tough. I mean, I can tell you what I was thinking at age 20 and 18. I had this romantic notion that did not pan out, that I was going to skip school and become a sailor. I wanted to work on racing boats, in fact, specifically. But the type of person that could have a seasonal career where you maybe take care of a big racing yacht in Rhode Island, you sail down to the Caribbean, you do the race season, and then you come back, right? And you can make a career out of that. And it was a way for me to be around the water and be outdoors all the time and do things that I thought would be interesting. And
quick,
I had this
interruption. I'm sorry, yep. If you don't mind. So you love water.
I do.
So you coached a swim team, you worked as a lifeguard. I remember being at a conference one day at Lake Tahoe, and I got up and I'm having my eggs and coffee in the morning, and Kent Lastman comes walking up from the water because he just swam across Lake Tahoe, which is not a small lake.
It's a big one.
And what's the story there? And do you still sail?
I don't still sail. I did. You know, I grew up in Illinois. The biggest body of water was the Mississippi, not a sailing outlet, if you're not familiar. I did my first sailing when I was 19 years old.
So you were nowhere near the lake then?
I'm sorry?
Your part of Illinois was nowhere near the lake then?
Nowhere near the Great Lakes. Closer to Iowa.
Gotcha.
I found one of the things that I learned crewing on a sailboat was it's not that fun.
No,
there's a lot of tedium and a lot of stress, and I just didn't enjoy it. I mean, it's much different to be a passenger than to be a crew, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the first lesson. But I had this romantic notion that I would be like Hemingway minus the writing. You know, I would just go and read books and sail and be in the sunshine all the time. Well, that didn't pan out right away. And what I really thought once I got into school and study and involved in policy was that my path would take me toward foreign policy, security issues, those sorts of questions. And there's almost a path dependency. The opportunities that showed up in front of me that at each juncture made it more likely that a similar opportunity would come, they all had to do with domestic policy. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, more and more, they had to do with regulatory law. Probably the key juncture was I didn't know any better, and I was trying to make a decision about my first Washington internship. And I had I had two offers, one where I was going to have a very regimented kind of fixed program that was run over and over and over again the same way. And that was with the Embassy of Israel. And the other was with a think tank where they just needed help. And I would get to do lots of different things, and I'd be exposed to all of their scholars. And I chose the latter because I thought it was more exciting than to go through this formal program. Although it was the embassy job that was closer to what I was studying and what I thought my interests were going to be. And I think I probably still would be involved in public policy. I think I still would be involved in some sort of mission-driven organization, kind of ideologically rooted organization. Those things I don't think would change, but the focus would be different.
Gotcha. How much is your work experience and how has it influenced your policy views? I shy away from the word ideology, but I guess in this context, we all know what we're talking about. You know, you've got certain views about how the world works, to repeat the phrase from the beginning of the podcast, and what makes it work, and how we can achieve a, you know, better, more dynamic, more prosperous, happier, more fulfilling kind of society. You know, you ask this question to people in our world, and there are a lot of people who will tell you, I read an Ayn Rand novel when I was 11 years old or 14 years old or something like that, and that's never my favorite story for all sorts of reasons. Then there are other people who are, well, I had, you know, this experience. I worked at this place and I saw this, you know, terrible weird, political bad incentives or the way the regulation worked, or I never understood. Oh, you get the PJ O'Rourke story that I was a, flaming left winger until I got my first paycheck and looked at the deductions and went and joined the
FICA Party.
Yeah. Who the hell's FICA? And why is he getting such a big bite? So, how did your work experiences before you became someone who did advocacy in a sense for a living, affect what it was you wanted to advocate?
It's something that was formative, but it remains part of the everyday. It's just how I understand, as you said, how I understand things happen, how the world actually works is, it's a concept that a lot of our friends are very comfortable with in an academic setting, but I see it much more in a mundane way. Like it shows up all the time, everywhere I go. And it was in all of those jobs. And it's the notion of tacit knowledge. And, there are ways that we do things. The way you stack bales of hay in a barn not only matters for when you take them out later, but it matters. It is important to distinguish how wet the hay is when it goes in. Because as it dries, you can have a fire, right? The explosions. This is a very serious matter. And there's a lot of knowledge that's just passed on how you do these things and when you change them and when you don't. And the same thing applies for, I was with my son this weekend out in a place called Chantilly, Virginia. And we had a half an hour before we were due to see my wife. And she was not going to tolerate us being late. And I said, we're going to go in here and I'm going to get a cup of tea at Starbucks. Right. And we went in and it was the busiest Saturday Starbucks I think I've seen in my life. And the woman behind the counter, the barista, we stood in front of her as she did. No, I'm not kidding, because I counted the first three dozen. She must have done 60 drinks. And the efficiency and the way she organized and she'd pull the lever here and pour the milk there simultaneously, the way she did all of that, there are ways to innovate. There are ways to make money. There are ways to create more value for someone else. There's ways to improve safety that are happening all the time. And you just have to make it possible for people to do them.
Yeah.
And if you over regiment, if you over plan, if you over anything, that all comes down to control, you don't have those benefits. And it was a marvel. Like, we stood and watched the marvel of this woman handle 60 drinks.
Yeah. There is a certain pleasure in just watching someone who's really, really good at what they do, irrespective of what that thing is, even if it's something you don't really understand very well, I think. Sometimes I have that feeling watching sports. I don't really follow sports very closely, but when you watched Michael Jordan play basketball, there was something exciting about that, even if you weren't really a basketball fan, just to watch someone who was so good at the thing that he chose to do in life.
I was just going to say, I think we're drawn toward excellence, right? I think that's hardwired into us. Both we want to provide it and, as you're saying, witness it. And not to get too wonky on you, philosophical on you, this is not a new idea. Right. Adam Smith. Right. Yeah. He gave us this notion. He created that he was a social psychologist more than an economist. He's inventing neoclassical economics. But he gave us this idea of the impartial spectator. And the notion is outside of you, there's someone who's watching your behavior that is helping you move toward what is right. And that rightness or that goodness is, in his framework, creating value for others. Bartering and exchange is a good thing.
Yeah. I remember having that sort of epiphany when I was first reading Milton Friedman. I was in high school. And right before I started high school in the summer between junior high and high school, I'd worked at Burger King. And I was not paid minimum wage, but I was paid like minimum wage plus like maybe $1.50 or something like that. So, pretty low paying job, but not a terrible job by any stretch of the imagination. And I worked there just for the summer. And wasn't going to work during the school year. And it occurred to me later, thinking about it, that after 3 months of working at Burger King as as a starting nobody shift employee, I knew a lot more about how Burger King works than the people who write the laws that regulate how Burger King's work. they don't know anything about it. And whereas, you know, Penny, the lady who was the store manager there at the time, who'd been there in that job for, I guess, probably 7 or 8 years at that point, really knew a lot about this. But then this is the big Hayekian point, of course, that there's no way to get that knowledge out of the store managers and the workers and the people who actually do this stuff, because stuff changes so quickly and everything is very localized, into the hands of the people who think that they can kind of organize the world in a rational way. And once I really kind of understood that idea, it really changed how I think about, you know, almost everything having to do with how government works, but particularly with how regulation of economic activity works. Although, as you're often quick to point out, this stuff is not limited to its application to economic activity. We're getting close to the end of our time, and I did have one last question I wanted to ask you.
This is the hardball, right?
What's that?
This is the hardball?
No, it's not that. On July 3rd, 1975, whatever was going on then. No, I often ask people if they have any professional regrets. And I always wince a little bit when I ask people about that, because there's a certain sort of person who says, well, I have no regrets. And that kind of person either has never done anything interesting in life or is too dumb to know what he should be regretting. I have lots of regrets about lots of things, including things I've done professionally that I wish I'd done differently over the years. And can you give me an example? This sounds like a job interview now, but I think it's worth asking the question of sometime when you really got something wrong, or when you missed an opportunity to get something right, that you learned something from, and really that it shaped how you went forward there from your work.
I'm hesitant. The first thing that comes to mind, I'm hesitating about, only because it actually eventually ended well, as mm-hmm. so many of these stories do. But I'll tell you something that I don't think I handled particularly well. You know, I wish it worked out differently. There was a point in my career where I had been doing policy work, analysis, and advocacy, for more than a dozen years. And I was living in North Carolina. And for many of those years, about half of that time, I was flying around the country, visiting state capitals, working with governors and attorney general and you know, state legislators. It was very rewarding. But I thought, I had this notion that I either need to go to the private sector and learn something else, or I need to move to Washington, because there was this ceiling on how much I could really keep learning and keep doing and advancing and becoming better at my analytical role. And an opportunity came up, and the opportunity required me to move to Washington, which I decided to do. And I decided to do it about 18 months after having bought a home. And I decided to do it only a few months after learning that we were going to be expecting twins in my household.
Mm.
And so this was more than the job. This was a major life change to move from Raleigh, North Carolina to what turned out to be Northern Virginia, work in Washington, and take a management role. I mean, that was the big distinction. I was going to stop working on my field of expertise, my subject matter, and then help manage an organization. And as it turned out, moving a pregnant wife is not a great thing. Making major financial decisions, like trying to buy a home in the Washington area after, you know, sorting that stuff out, that didn't work out well. And then the job itself was not quite as secure as I thought, or as advertised or whatnot. You know, I made a poor decision about that. And I got along with people. I did good work. I remain on good terms with the people I worked with, but it didn't last. You know, it was like an 18-month job, which in hindsight, I know, well, that's a typical job in Washington. About 18 to 30 months is how long they last.
Yeah.
So why was I surprised? And I didn't have the vision to understand that there would have been a wonderful life for us had I figured things out in Raleigh, North Carolina, right? I didn't have to come to Washington. I didn't have to take that leap. And it certainly would have been a different path. And I think in that narrow time frame would have been much easier, because suddenly we had three toddlers at home, or infants and toddlers, and you know, like all of these things were happening at once, and that was painful.
Well, hearing you talk about that particular domestic situation, I could give you a lot of very specific feedback that I'm not going to give you right now.
It worked out well, right? Yes. Like it worked obviously out very well. The home, the family, the this, the that. So that comes to mind. But you know, really the hardest things, I don't know if they create regrets, but they do create second guessing over time. They all seem to me to come back to personnel questions, right? Having to part ways with somebody, taking a pass when you thought like, maybe I'll hire this woman, or I'll take this guy on and we'll see if we can make it work, and then deciding not to and watching that person succeed elsewhere. Those things are hard, right? They cause some second guessing.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a real specific one that jumps out in my mind for some reason. I was running a newspaper called the Philadelphia Bulletin, which I had helped start. And we had a relatively small staff, and they were mostly young people. And I kind of always hated like general staff meetings. And I've always thought they were a waste of time. People have other things to do. And I didn't need to have an open door policy because I didn't have an office door. You know, I had my desk out in the middle of the newsroom. And I thought of myself as being someone who was, you know, relatively easy to talk to, and that people who had problems or feedbacks or whatever could just come talk to me about it, because I genuinely welcomed that kind of stuff, and we could yell at each other and that would be fine. And so I just didn't have any staff meetings for like, I don't know, 6 or 7 months or something like that. Just, we're not going to do that. You know, I'll come ask you questions. You come ask me questions. We're not that big an organization. We don't need to do this. Well, you may have noticed this. I didn't know this at the time, but it turns out that people who are about 10, 15 years younger than you and me like meetings. And not having that structure and having a place and an occasion that's kind of sanctioned to bring up stuff that you're unhappy with or that you feel that needs to be brought up. And even though I didn't think of myself as being a particularly hard boss, apparently some people like the idea of going and bringing something up that's uncomfortable in a one-on-one conversation with the editor was really hard for people. And months into this, I actually, you know, was talking to a couple of staffers who were like, we really wish, you know, we would have a meeting so we feel like we could talk about stuff. And it turns out this is a really well understood thing among people who do a lot more personnel management than I had at the time. And but I think that I thought that I was doing everyone a favor and running things in the way that was the easiest for everyone. And when it turns out, I was just kind of implementing my preferences, assuming that they were generally and universally held because they're so obviously the right ones. But it's just, it doesn't always work out that way. But that little lesson, for some reason, is stuck in my head that different people just really have different expectations about what makes them comfortable in a work environment. And they're not always the ones you expect them to be.
And they're not stable, right? They change for all of us through time. Like there's different trends. But then for an individual employee, they change over time as they learn more, they gain more experience, they'll have different preferences.
Yeah, that was the newspaper business. Nobody was stable in any sense, but we were just happy if they showed up sober. And that was a good start. All right. Well, I've enjoyed the conversation very much. Maybe we'll do this again sometime. Kent Lastman, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Kevin. This has been a treat. I look forward to next time around.
That concludes our most recent episode of How the World Works. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Kent Lastman. You can watch the video of the whole interview on YouTube. There'll be a link in the show notes for that. And we will see you next month with another episode.